This is Layla Mudin, RD. I see patients every day here at the Hoffman Center. If you require a nutrition consult with me, but live out of town, there's no need to travel to New York City. I have telephone consultations with clients from all over the country. Please visit drhoffman.com for more information. And to set up an appointment, call 212-779-1744. That's 212-779-1744. I look forward to being a collaborator in your healthcare.
Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, today with Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mudin. We're doing our weekly Q&A with Layla. So, how you doing, Layla?
All right, Dr. Hoffman. How's it going?
Good, good. You know, I forgot to tell you in part one that I had a great conversation last week with Nina Teicholz. Are you familiar with Nina Teicholz?
Oh,
she wrote A Big Fat Surprise. And that, you know, I know that if you're already listening to this podcast, you know, telling people to listen to podcasts who are already listening to podcasts is kind of, you know, we presume that you're listening to a lot of podcasts. But if you haven't heard that one, please dial it up. Many of you subscribe so you get your podcast in your inbox and, you know, you listen to most of them. But don't miss this one because it's great. As you know, Layla, Nina is someone who is an investigative journalist, but also with a strong background in biology. She was a pre-med at she went to both Stanford and Yale. And so she has a really strong science background. Anyway, she wrote an article in the British Medical Journal, which is unusual for a non-physician or a non-PhD researcher, but she raised such cogent points in relationship to the Dietary Guidelines for America, the DGA, which unfortunately lag behind, you know, science, which they still argue for a low-fat diet, for avoidance of saturated fat, for you know, reducing your red meat intake, for swapping butter for vegetable oil, and for using low-fat dairy.
Yeah.
And so she wrote a very cogent and scientifically based critique of the DGA in the British Medical Journal. It's now called the BMJ instead of the British Medical Journal, but same initials. And she was subject to a firestorm of protest. And in fact, she was attacked, you know, because she didn't have any scientific credentials. And, you know, who is she to weigh in on the dietary guidelines? They have these illustrious PhD scientists who've come up with these recommendations for the American public. And so she talks about her, she chronicles her, the saga in this podcast, which is really extraordinary. She's really a crusader on behalf of what I believe is the right way to go.
Yeah.
Did you know, Leta, and we might not have discussed this, but I discussed this on my radio show. I know I'm taking time away from questions, but it's important. There was an article, if you haven't yet seen it, maybe you haven't gotten around to it, but in this month's American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, a really important study, and the study was entitled "Total Red Meat Intake of Greater Than 0.5 Servings Per Day Does Not Negatively Influence Cardiovascular Disease Risk Factors." Okay, now just pause for a second. What is that saying? Okay, why do they say 0.5 servings per day? I mean, you and I consume more than that. I mean, right? But what they're saying, that's precisely the recommendation of the DASH diet and the American Heart Association. They're saying don't have more than a half serving per day. Well, who has a half serving? Maybe that means like 2 or 3 days a week. It's okay to have red meat, but have a palm-sized serving, okay? They really want you to curtail. So they said, well, let's do in this study, let's look at all the studies that speak to this issue. And they looked at like 800 studies, and they found that about 80-some studies met the criteria for these are decent studies. So this is what it called, this is what is called a meta-analysis. And then they aggregated the data, and what they found is that greater than 0.5 per day did not cause any increased risk of cardiovascular risk factors. You know, they looked at cholesterol, looked at HDL, they looked at, you know, all manner of risk factors associated with heart disease. And in fact, in those studies, on average, people consumed 1.8 servings per day. Mm-hmm. But they also looked at a subgroup where people consumed greater than 3 servings per day of red meat. I don't know how you do that. What do you wake up and have a hamburger and then have a,
that's a lot,
roast beef for lunch and, you know, finish it with a filet mignon? Or, you know, I don't know what, how you,
yeah,
do that.
That'll get boring quick.
Yeah. Yeah, but they found there was no increased risk of cardiovascular disease. So that is huge. How many people are reporting on this? Did you pick up your, your New York Times, your Wall Street Journal, and see the headlines on page one, like,
no,
and red meat
and
does not cause
that,
heart disease?
No. But listen, I was just at a conference all day on Saturday here in the New York area.
Yeah.
And a prominent cardiologist came on from one of the great big New York hospitals and proposing a complete vegan diet, quoted the China study upwards and downwards. And do you know what movie they have in their coronary care unit that they have on a loop reel for their patients to watch over
forks
and over and
forks
over
and
again?
Knives. Forks and knives.
Yes, forks over knives.
Forks over knives, yeah.
Forks over knives.
Right.
So that was one. That was one of the,
but you know,
that was one of the sessions.
Can I just comment? This is a,
oh, yeah.
What you have there is you have a, I mean, the guy is a qualified cardiologist.
Cardiologist,
and
yes.
He's, you know, I mean, if the guy had to do, God forbid, a stent on me or, you know, some procedure, he's probably very skilled, and it's a product of years and years of training. But here's a guy who's a fanatic, who's personally committed to a vegetarian diet and is not maybe scientific in his orientation to his craft, which is cardiology, but is ignoring the facts from a nutritional standpoint, and is just, and I'm sure that he's a ultra thin guy. He probably, you know, does marathons and believes that by eating, tons of grains and beans and tofu and, and kale, that he's going to cheat the Grim Reaper.
Right. Now, what's interesting to me is, of course, he quoted, you know, the studies in the China study, the book by T. Colin Campbell,
which is the most unscientific, the most unscientific thing I've ever read.
Yeah,
it's a polemic.
Because so much of the scientific research in that book was cherry picked. The other thing that I noticed in this cardiologist presentation is he also quoted some very old research. I'm talking about from 1986.
Yep.
From 1991.
Right.
Look. I don't mean to insult anybody, but even as an undergraduate in my research class, I was told, bar none, you do not quote any scientific research older than 10 years.
Right. I do it.
Unless, of course, I do it for
historical purposes.
Article. That's different.
Yeah. I do it
that's
for
different.
Historical purposes. Like I did an article recently.
For historical purposes, that's different.
Yeah.
But, you know, he just quoted these old articles that were debunked many times over.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, well, okay, here come my continuing education credits.
Well, he probably still listens to, disco and Duran Duran and, you know, Donna Summers, you know, that kind of thing.
Wait, I like Duran Duran. Wait a minute.
You know, music didn't stop in the 80s, you know, and nor did science.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So this is what we're talking about. It's not being translated to healthcare, to doctors, and so forth, and even to some degree with nutritionists. So,
okay.
Mainstream anyway.
We got off track. Let's try to take some questions because, you know, we try to answer questions in order here, but, you know, it's sort of like, all our agents are busy, you know, please, stay on the line. We appreciate your call. You know, we'll try to get to you as soon as an operator is available.
Yes, your questions are important to us.
Right.
Please stay on the line.
Right. So we'll get to questions.
We have an email from Gabby. Dear Dr. Hoffman, I heard that you mentioned you suffered from cold hands and that you remedied the problem with fish oil. I'm a 53-year-old female and present with similar symptoms, which has been diagnosed as Raynaud's syndrome. All that's been offered to me is blood pressure meds, but since my BP reading are on the low side, I'm reluctant to go this route.
It's a specific type of blood pressure medications. They're what are called calcium channel blockers, and calcium channel blockers have the ability to block calcium, which triggers vasoconstriction. And so they're used sometimes for Raynaud's. They're not very effective, and they have a lot of side effects. So please don't use the blood pressure medications for that unless it's just an agonizing condition. There's so many natural alternatives to that. One is my favorite, of course, is fish oil, but you got to take it for a while. It took me several seasons of high-dose fish oil to overcome my my Raynaud's. And, you know, every year it just gets better and better because I guess there's a cumulative effect of high-dose fish oil consumption. You know, it used to be that I would get ultra-painful fingers anytime it was below, you know, like 45 degrees. And now it's okay. It's only the single-digit days they get to my fingers. You know, I wear mittens now. Mittens, by the way, are a better way of keeping your hands warm because they allow you to keep your fingers together. I think when you separate your fingers are more likely to individually get cold, even with the thickest gloves. So
it's the body heat idea, you know?
Yeah.
Keeping the fingers together is probably a better idea. Dr. Hoffman, how much fish oil, Gabby is asking?
Well, you know, I think I would go hard on fish oil if you're not having any kind of blood thinning effects, you know, susceptibility to bruising.
If you're not on aspirin therapy,
I would go,
if you're not on other blood thinning
medications. I would go six EPA DHA daily for a period of a year or two. And, you know, other things that might help, pycnogenol might help. We know it has some vasodilating effect. There's some prospects for some of the products that contain arginine. You know, we use a product called Perfusia, which is an arginine product.
Yes.
And it has to do with perfusion. Arginine is a nitric oxide generating amino acid. Some of the new products include some citrulline along with the arginine. That's the latest innovation for nitric oxide generation. And then, of course, there are products like Heart Greens, which is a sponsor of my radio program, and Super Beets, which generate nitric oxide, which is also vasodilating, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, I would say certainly exercise is beneficial.
Great for circulation.
Sure.
Yep.
So those are some of the things that can help with that. And then there was a product called Oligonol that we used for a while, which is also a polyphenol, but they changed the name on that product. Do you remember the new name for Oligonol?
No, actually. I think
we sell it at the Hoffman Center store, but Oligonol underwent a name change. But it's actually, there are some studies on Oligonol, which is it's a lychee fruit extract. Here, I'm gonna share this
from
with
the
you.
Lychee fruit.
Check this out.
Mm-hmm.
I just dialed it up. Effect of lychee fruit extract, Oligonol on peripheral circulation, a pilot study. Skin thermography demonstrates vasodilatation effects of polyphenol. So, Oligonol is the generic name, and it's a highly bioavailable source of low molecular weight polyphenols extracted from lychee fruit. The results suggest that Oligonol might act as a vasodilator and be an effective treatment for a variety of vasoconstriction symptoms such as cold hands and feet, shoulder discomfort, and diabetes-related vascular problems. So that's kind of a fun study, right? I don't know. They did change the name, but it's the ingredient that's the thing. I guess you might have to call the Hoffman Center, call us on our 800 number to ask the dispensary person what product reflects that. But that would be recommended.
And the lychee fruit, to me, is most resembles a grape. It's an Asian fruit. So I want to say it's like an Asian grape.
Okay.
I've tasted one. It tastes like a green grape to me, to some degree, but richer, somewhat richer.
Yeah.
Delicious. Okay.
Oh wait, I found it. Whew. Okay. See, I had to Google. I had to Google my own website. Okay, it's called Metasol. Metasol. Okay.
Metasol.
Metasol. Okay. Metasol. So.
Right. That must have been a very recent change. Okay.
Yeah. And I don't know why they had to change the name, but if you Ask for Metasol. You know, you can order it online, or you can call the Hoffman Center number and obtain it. But oliganol is the ingredient, but the product is Metasol. Okay?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Gabby, thank you very much for your email. We hope you feel better.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, bump up your fish oil if you're taking some.
Hey, sounds like maybe I should write article about this. I think I should write an article about this because it's kind of cool.
Yeah. There you go. We have an email from another Michael.
Mm-hmm.
Dear Dr. Hoffman and Layla, a dear friend told me that during a routine exam, a mass was found on her ovary.
Mm-hmm.
She went to a gynecologist-oncologist who said that the ovary should be removed and that biopsies aren't done on ovaries because doing so may metastasize the malignancy if, indeed, it's malignant.
Mm-hmm.
Well, she's reluctant to have the ovary removed without first knowing whether it's benign
or
not.
I just comment
on
that.
What is your take?
I'll just comment on that. It's kind of interesting because, you know, it's kind of a paradoxical statement because so commonly we do breast biopsies, we do prostate biopsies, and, you know, when asked the question, oh, you know, should I get a biopsy? Could it spread the cancer? They reassure you. They say, no way. No. Don't worry about it. Now, there may be something qualitatively different about an ovary than other tissue, but I got to say it's kind of a double standard. On the one hand, they say, oh, biopsies are fine. Thyroid biopsy is very commonly performed. And then ovarian biopsies, which may be qualitatively different, where there's a much higher likelihood of spread and it's been well documented. And besides, ovarian cancer can be very deadly and devastating. Those other forms of cancer are a little less virulent, although they can kill you. I'm not, you know, a gynecological surgeon. I can't speak to that issue, but I sense a little bit of a paradox there. But the fact that, see, very often there are ovarian masses detected. It's very common for women to have ovarian cysts that are big. They're like inches long, and they're the result of an egg that comes to the surface on the ovary and then can form a water-filled, kind of like a water balloon, that then expands and expands, and finally it bursts. And this is a painful event in the life of some women. I don't know if you've experienced this, but a burst ovarian cyst is like, it can be really painful. But it's normal. It's benign. It's not dangerous. Okay. And it's easy to see that, you know, when they look at it with ultrasound, presumably she's had some kind of visualization, some kind of ultrasound or some imaging test to look at this mass. And they were concerned enough to say, no, this isn't the run of the mill cyst, which we can kind of watch.
Right. It's not just a physiologic cyst, not an ovulation cyst.
Yeah, it's something suspicious. Yeah. It's something suspicious. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes they pull their punches. They say, wow, this woman's got ovarian cancer. And they say, well, you know, we're not going to alarm the patient. We're just going to say, look, we got to go in there and we've got to take it out. You know, it's like, let's break the bad news when we have to. Pretty sure it's cancer. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what fact base she's operating on. And what they're seeing, but it sounds like if they want to take it out, probably needs to come out. Now, I wish I had a buck for every woman who's had her ovary taken out. When it's turned out to be fine, I've many patients who have one ovary as a result of ovary removal where it wasn't cancer. But actually, that's a bad news, good news scenario. Well, they took out your ovary unnecessarily, but the good news is that it was highly suspicious for cancer, and turns out you don't have cancer. So I don't know. You know, it sounds to me like
the type of an ovarian cyst. This I've heard of, a type of an ovarian cyst that's just not going to reabsorb itself,
right?
As in ovulation or something like that, but just something that needs to be removed.
Yeah.
So
you know, I wish there was a workaround on that, but I can't say there is.
Yeah. Except possibly a second opinion, but you imagine that all gynecological oncologists are going to, you know, toe that same line of it should come out, I would imagine. Yeah.
By the way, I just read an article about ovarian cancer treated with intravenous vitamin C and vitamin K3. K3 is actually something added to the bag of the IV solution. When combined with the chemo drug cisplatin, because that's the drug that's most often used for ovarian cancer, and the IV vitamin C with the vitamin K really boosted the efficacy of cisplatin in treating the ovarian cancer. So, should it turn out to be that, that I would recommend that.
Yeah. All right, Michael, best of luck to your friend.
Yep.
Wow.
We have time for a quick question.
A quick question. Ah, okay. This comes from Jack. Jack says, I just had my gallbladder removed, and I'm not a vegetarian, nor do I intend to become one. I'm writing to inquire whether digestive enzymes would be appropriate for me, because I will continue eating, you know, animal fat, vegetable fats, all of that. And I realize it's desirable to keep fats to minimum, especially since I have no gallbladder.
No, that's not true.
So what would you advise?
That's not true. Have you found that that's the case that people should
No, not at all. I think what happens in the beginning, when the gallbladder is removed, and just so our listeners know, the gallbladder is actually a depot that stores the bile that the liver secretes. It just kind of hangs out there until the gallbladder contracts to release some of that bile into the stomach. And this happens after a fatty meal, a moderate fat meal, a high fat meal, whatever that may be. And what happens normally right after a gallbladder surgery is because the bile has nowhere to be stored, it kind of maybe is secreted a little seemingly indiscriminately because it doesn't have a house to go to before it lands in the stomach, that many patients will experience some diarrhea as a result in the beginning.
So it says it does. Some of the recommendations are to adopt a low-fat diet initially. But that, I think that's the bias anyway. I think that they want everybody to be on a low-fat diet, so they're using it as an excuse. Yeah.
And you know what? A very low-fat diet, a very, very low-fat diet may be the reason for any creation of gallstones or any gallbladder trouble to begin with.
Yeah.
Because that gallbladder needs a reason to contract. And if there's no fat in the diet, maybe that bile's going to just hang out there and crystallize over time.
Yeah.
And so, form stones. So again, the advice to follow a low-fat diet after a gallbladder removal, I wouldn't go with. Digestive enzymes are absolutely appropriate to answer Jack's question.
Absolutely. And, you know, especially those that contain lipase, which is the fat-digesting enzyme. High lipase pancreatin might be in order. But ordinarily, I mean, what happens sometimes when people have their gallbladder removed is they start gaining more weight because they had at least an impediment to overeating before they would get a gallbladder attack. And then now they can eat with impunity. So, they, like you say, there may be an additional adjustment period wherein you should not eat super fatty foods, high, you know, fried foods, which aren't good for you.
I wouldn't go out and get baby back ribs after a gallbladder surgery.
No, celebrate, that, right? But and also smaller volume meals, you know, smaller volume meals also.
Smaller, more frequent meals, moderate to low in fat in the beginning, and then just advancing as appropriate.
And it's, you know, just in terms of a little article here that I'm pulling up, you know, how do you digest fats without a gallbladder? You do.
Exactly. Your liver is still secreting bile. It just doesn't have a depot to be housed in anymore. So it's just kind of secreting it. And you know, the body has a wonderful way of adjusting itself or readjusting itself to something that may be lacking, you know.
Yeah. Good. All right. Those were good questions.
Thank you, Jack, for your question.
Great. We'll post
Some digestive enzymes. One or two with each meal is probably appropriate. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Okay. Well, thanks very much, Layla, for your contribution. Thanks for joining us today, listeners. And a reminder that we enjoy doing this podcast, and we offer it as a free service to our listeners. But in order to help underwrite this project, we ask that you take a look at our Hoffman Center store. You can go to drhoffman.com and click on the store, peruse the products there, patronize our website, because, well, that's the way that, in part, we underwrite our efforts to share vital health information with you. That's all for this week. Thanks, Layla. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.